Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Join us on Monday evening, U.S. Eastern Time, as we explore homeopathy and facial analysis, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brooks and Grant Bentley, homeopath and naturopath. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brooks, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host this evening, Grant Bentley, Australian homeopath and specialist in the facial analysis method. Today is October 17th, 2011. Whether you are new to homeopathy or continuing your lifelong study, you will find this information innovative and a great addition to your healing toolbox. We're asking you to tweet, email, message on Facebook, and share to your friends in any way that you can to let them know about this opportunity to listen and ask questions on the live chat. With just 30 minutes to our regular show, this series is going to be jam-packed with a lot of information. Just because today is a special introduction, we're going to have a full hour show. Well, most of the time, we're going to ask you to send in some comments via email or right on the live chat. For those who are new to Blog Talk Radio, you will find the chat right below the announcement page on the website for Blog Talk Radio Homeopathy World Community. If you would like to sponsor one of our shows, please contact us by friending the show and sending a message. I really have a hearty welcome to Grant Bentley. It's been a lot of working around to get us together over this year and prepare the show. He is the founder of the Victorian College of Classical Homeopathy, the Homeopathic Facial Analysis. It's shortened to HFA, and it's research in Melbourne, Australia. I'm sure he probably has a different accent than I do. Grant is a qualified homeopath and naturopath and has studied clinical hypnosis and has a postgraduate diploma in Ericksonian psychotherapy. Grant is the current principal and senior lecturer of the Victorian College of Classical Homeopathy. And I did take one of Grant's classes. He's on the line with us now. I'm very excited he was able to get on. And when I took your course, Grant, it was very late at night for me. I was tired. And you can talk a mile a minute really, really fast and pack it in with such substance that everybody's going to have to listen really closely to catch everything that he teaches. if you want to say hello, just to make sure our sound is good here.
Okay. Hi, Debbie. How are you?
I'm doing great. Let's just take a look at what time are you right now in Melbourne?
We're 11:04 a.m.
So you're in the morning. You're about 11 hours ahead of me, and it is now 8 o'clock at night on the East Coast. So I'm always going to be trying to catch up to you.
It's going to take a little bit to catch us, I think.
I'm just going to be running the whole way. So ever since 1987, Grant has been studying in various fields of natural therapies with his expertise in homeopathy, naturopathy, clinical hypnosis, and Ericksonian psychotherapy, which I mentioned earlier. You can always visit him and find lots and lots of information on his website, www.vcch.org. And you've also written two books. The first one's called Appearance and Circumstance, written in 2003, with details about the nature of miasms. It's always a big question for homeopaths to learn about miasms. And just recently, I posted a brand new blog on Homeopathy World Community all about Dr. Chatterjee and his work with Serinum 6, I think it was 6C or 6X, which actually was healing a good number of patients who had stomach, liver, gallbladder, and pancreatic cancer. So I'm really interested in learning more about the miasms. And then you also put that together with a facial analysis, which can be used to determine a patient's stress response using classical homeopathy. And then you also wrote two more books. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. The next book was more it's a book that details how to take facial analysis and how to transfer it into each miasmatic category. And then the second book after that was called Soul and Survival, which is more about the patient's stories and the philosophy that I learned about how people trap themselves into cycles and exactly what energy exchange is and pretty much how homeopathy works for that. But it's Soul and Survival is about what I began understanding was that there is a lot of inherited memories that are taking place that sometimes are coming from our own lives, but sometimes they are lives of previous generations. I'm not necessarily talking about people going through reincarnation, but what I'm talking about here is almost a Darwinian concept of taking the things that work, the strategies that work, and particularly when it's pitted against trying to survive. And so what we do as human beings is that because we are not passing on camouflage or size or other sort of physical traits like other animals, I came to the conclusion that we are passing on a lot of knowledge regarding different dangerous experiences, both socially and physically, and also a lot of the ideas that we got us out of those dangerous situations. So we have both the recognition of the danger itself, plus the successful response being passed on, because of course knowledge is how human beings survive. So it in a Darwinian sense, suits the purpose of passing on prior knowledge rather than, you know, just in the same way leopards get passed on spots or tigers stripes and so on.
We don't
survive by the camouflage. We survive by knowledge. So by making sure that dangerous knowledge and the responses that got us out of that knowledge, out of that dangerous situation are passed on, then Mother Nature ensures that each generation is provided with the best set of skills and circumstances for both recognition and response. But of course, what we're finding in the clinic is that patients are coming in these states and reacting, or at least in their way, in their mind, overreacting instinctively to particular types of stresses. And these stresses are so lock and key with them that they can often be caught in a cycle, and they don't know why they're responding in the manner that they are doing, and why that this particular stimulus should be affecting them so dramatically when it's not necessarily affecting the people around them anywhere near as dramatically. But I understand that that's because the people that surround them don't have the same instinctive memory. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about why the book is called Soul and Survival, is because soul is about the mind and our consciousness, whereas survival is this survival instinct. And this kind of locks it back into Hahnemann, because he talks about the vital force as being instinctual and quite separate from our reason-gifted mind. And so as a result of that, that's why the book titles Soul and Survival, because patience are caught in their survival instinct. They are, it's kind of as if they are looking at themselves, wishing that they could change, but not having the facilities or the methods to be able to make the appropriate changes. So that's the basis of the third book.
I see. Well, I mean, I'm just going to ask a question after listening to this, because maybe other people are thinking the same thing, that throughout the ages, through our lineage, you're saying that our parents, grandparents, and so on had certain circumstances in their life that influenced them, causing them either the flight or fight response, some kind of a stress or a danger or threat. But I guess I'm asking, all of that is manifest now in appearance of the facial structure, which we know for sure. You know, whenever a baby is born, we always say, oh, who does he or she look like? The mother, the father, the aunts or the uncles, or the grandparents. So this is become very attached to a child when they look like a particular parent.
Mm-hmm. What we're saying here is that, look, all of that genetic memory that we're talking about is essentially what, in homeopathic terms, we call the miasms. And so for right from the beginning, we've always understood that there are different mental outlooks and emotional responses associated with each one of these miasms. But what I've begun to understand is that it's a lot more than that, and it's more than just a disease category. It's a way that nature is trying to protect us by passing on a set of memories and reactions. Now, each one of these set of memories and reactions, you'll see in the remedies of of each one of these particular miasms, and people fall into this. So what you might find is, and we know this for a fact, for example, that some people can go through their lives and, emotional breakups or things of that nature may not affect them very much. However, if their business collapses, then they're almost ready to jump out of a window, whereas other people, their business can collapse and they can look at their partner and say, okay, well, we're just going to have to start again. At least we've got each other. So what we see there is the way that different stresses strike at the core of people. And what I'm saying is that I've noticed that core is what we would, as homeopaths, determine or call the miasms. Now, what we also have in as far as our facial features come in, because we are very much social creatures and we have been living in groups long before language developed, it's very important that we convey our needs and we try to convey our strengths and we try to hide our weaknesses from other people around us. And we do that with body language. Most experts confer that up to 90% of communication is nonverbal. But what we've never really taken into account is whether or not our survival instinct is going to try and attract towards us the people and the circumstances that are best able to suit us. Now, this is where the face comes in. When you start looking at sore, psychosis, syphilis, and so on, if you start looking at them as a force represented by the way they act, so their action on the body, what we see there is that sore is very outward motion, pushes things to the circumference, whereas psychosis encapsulates, syphilis goes inward. So what happened was that, and then you were talking about earlier about how the miasms, and you know, it's a very interesting field, and it's the same with me. I got very interested in this, but I got interested in it for, I guess, a different reason. And that reason was that it became quite clear that the way that I was practicing was not the way that I was teaching. There was a real discrepancy. I was teaching undergraduate homeopathy. I would sit down and I'd go through the organ on, I'd go through the classics like Alan Roberts and so on. And one of the things that you pick up, of course, is that the whole reason that Hahnemann wrote chronic diseases in the first place is because the symptom totality alone, which was really successful for acute disease, is just not holding when it comes to chronic disease. He was not getting anywhere near the success. And as a result of that, he had to delve into why that success wasn't occurring. Look, to cut a long story short, as everyone should already know anyway, is that he came up with his miasm theory. But the bottom line of that miasm theory is that anyone who is being treated for a chronic disease should have the underlying miasm as the basis of that prescription. Without it, you are just back to the symptom totality only. And remember, in chronic diseases, he does say that you have to intellectualize this. You're not going to be able to tell just by the signs and symptoms what miasm is the dominant one. Barninghausen, a very close friend of his, and was in close correspondence with Hahnemann, always used to write that you can't use pathology as an indicator to the miasm, and it's a very poor indicator. And so this is something that has to be intellectualized, but included into the prescription. And if you don't include it into the prescription, then you're just not going to get the same results as if you just do symptoms only. So what I found was that I'm teaching this on the one hand, but then I'm going into my clinic straight after the class, and I'm taking a case, particularly in those days where it was kind of what I would call a post-Kantian essence type of case, where it's, you know, I'm trying to understand if they are lycopodium or they are pulsatilla. I no longer think down this avenue anymore. I don't think essence prescribing is really all that effective after 20 years of practicing it. But what I saw was that a patient came in and said, well, look, my grandmother had tuberculosis or my dad got syphilis in the war or something or other, then unless they said the actual words, I was not really including the miasm in any way, shape or form like Hahnemann said that you should. There was, without doubt, if there was a lot of very severe pathology, I might give the syphilinum at the end. Or if there is a lot of lung pathology, that wasn't responding to remedies, I might try a tuberculinum. But essentially, I mean, these are what I understand now to be very primitive uses of anti-miasmatics and an understanding of the miasm. So essentially, that discrepancy, I just thought, well, you know, that's not really right. And so the whole thing started with me turning around now and saying, all right, well, I better find out exactly what Hahnemann meant by one of these miasms. Now, in the books, like I referred to earlier, Alan and Roberts, they talk about how if the internal miasm is going to be able to affect the physical body, then it has to shape aspects of the physical body. And so otherwise it wouldn't have any physical impact. And so as a result of that, I thought, well, you know, look, that makes sense. And then later on in the books, they talk about how, you know, this is a tubercular face and you can always see a syphilitic forehead because it's large and it's bulging and so on. And I just thought to myself, you know, that's really interesting. If the miasm not only is a creator of illness, this is what I was thinking at the time, is not only a creator of illness, and clearly it is so entwined with our physical nature, then it's actually Alan and Roberts and these guys are not making a quantum leap by saying, well, you should be able to see it in all aspects of our physical nature, including our facial features. So that's why they talk about this is the syphilitic forehead and this was the psoric chin and all this kind of, but they never really go on with it. So what I decided to do is that I decided to, just from a personal point of view, just see whether or not there was any accuracy to this. So originally I began with remedies that were very well recognized for being in a particular miasmatic category, such as sulfur for psora and thuya for psychosis, mercury for syphilis. So what I did is that I started taking photographs of patients to see what they had in common, because essentially what we're looking at here is a miasmatic genus epidemicus. We're looking at what the miasm in its entirety causes on the physical body, how it presents itself before pathology. Because what I began to realize is that if you can piece this together, then you have homeopathy's first and only objective diagnostic tool. So I began to take pictures of people, like, for example, if we take syphilis, where you've got aurum is a well-known syphilitic remedy, so is mercury, so is baryta carb. So when I would see patients that were successfully treated with these remedies, I would take pictures, compare them, and really scrutinize every single feature on the face until I began to see commonality. And that commonality was then logged into the, in this case, the syphilitic category. And so over time, we eventually built up a reservoir of facial features where not only I could begin to see that real commonality there, but I decided to take the next step. This was probably about 8 or 10 years ago. Began to take the next step of using it as a diagnostic tool. That is that do the facial analysis before I do the repertorization and base a remedy selection on the miasm that the facial analysis has given me. So it's very, I guess, post-Hahnemannian. Hahnemann doesn't talk about it very much himself, but most of our knowledge that we take from the miasms is definitely from people like Allen and Roberts. So it's very, very classical in that sense. It's just that it's never really been developed. And when you said earlier it's about structure, it's very important to point this out to people that we're not analyzing people's looks. We're not rating people's looks in this sense. And you can't just go out in the street and say, well, that person will be psoric, that one will be syphilitic. What it is it's a very precise measurement and structural guide of which we then analyze eyes, shape, position, so on, and then we do the same for the nose, the teeth, the chin, and so on. And each one of these is represented, as Alan was talking about, and very rightly, that if the miasm is going to influence and create on the physical body, then its expression should be seen in every feature. And they were both exactly right. And that's where we are now. We're now a long way down the track now. This is not a fly-by-night sort of, hey, here's a good idea. This has been very well researched, and every part of this is based on the clinic itself. If it wasn't working, and working meaning that we measure all truth in the only way that homeopathy should be measured, and that is by clinical success. And what we found is when we applied the facial analysis as a diagnostic tool, our results with patients with chronic disease, as Hahnemann predicted, because we are now using it as the basis of the prescription, just improved dramatically. Now we're a long way down the track. We've got better and better at it. It is a skill. It's not just something that you just decide, okay, well, I'll include it and I expect results by next Tuesday. You've got to really apply yourself to this, and it does take time. It takes years to understand how to discriminate remedies, and it takes you a reasonable amount of time to be able to discriminate facial features as well. It's not a predictive tool. It's not palm reading. It's not any of these things. It is there to fulfill what Hahnemann said we should do in the first place. And as often is the case, we find out that Hahnemann was right. And by its application, the results, like I said, are just dramatically improved.
Well, it sounds like you're having incredible success with it. All along you're talking, and like I said, you go at lightning speed. I had lots of comments along the way, but I just kept them to myself. Things like, it does take a long time to learn how to use this process. It is not just looking at somebody in the street or even a family member and knowing what miasm category you're going to make your remedy selection from. When you do this type of work, you ask the practitioner to provide specific frontal, side, three-quarter, whatever views of the face so it can be measured precisely and exactly to fit into all of the data gathering that you have done over the course of, I don't know if it's a decade or so. So that I understand. And it also sounded earlier on, you said Alan and Roberts, as if they actually had this knowledge and were using it, I don't know whether intuitively, but they didn't write it down. But it sounds like you had, like they were channeling this information to you, that somehow you captured this information and yet it is there hidden in between the lines of what they've written?
Look, I don't know if they were channeling this information. If they were channeling it, then they were whispering it because I couldn't hear them talking.
But they directed you. They directed you to, hey, take a look at this.
Well, there could be some truth in that because it's funny how things work, you know. I can remember, I started off with the syphilitic one because the reason that I started with the syphilis is because there used to be a branch of conventional medicine called syphilology, which is kind of, you wouldn't want to be slightly dyslexic to do that, but syphilology was this branch of medicine, and essentially what it was looking at was looking at the hereditary effects of syphilis. And one of the ways that they could tell about hereditosyphilis was by the different appearance of the children and the grandchildren. Now, obviously, the syphilis itself is not going to be present, so there's a diagnostic observable disease. It is the spirochete is not in the blood, but the effects of the syphilis on people's facial structure was very, very apparent. Now, Alan and Roberts are probably getting a lot of their information from this branch of syphilology because what they are talking about, and I got a very old, unique book on it, and what Alan and Roberts are talking about are the same facial features that are in this book. So it's very common knowledge at that time. But, of course, we know that there are three miasms, not one. And what we end up coming to the conclusion is that if one can do it, and each one is as destructive as the other and as powerful and as intertwined as the other, well, then if one can create all of this observable signs and symptoms and facial features like we see not only verified via homeopathy but verified via orthodox medicine as well, then why shouldn't psychosis and syphilis? And that's and SORA. And that was essentially that and Hahnemann's idea of, you know, make sure it's the basis of every chronic disease prescription was the starting point. And yeah, you're right. I mean, sometimes perhaps there is some channeling there, not necessarily direct in the sense of clairvoyance, because I'm about as sensitive as a doorknob when it comes to things like that. But what would happen is that I do think that there's a little bit of help along the way. I would say to Louise, my partner, for example, or I'd say to some students at the time, I really need to understand psychosis and its effect on something or other. And then, sure enough, I would get maybe 10 patients in a row that were all psychotic, and it would answer my question by the end of the week. And so as a result of that, the dossier of facial features actually came together very quickly. It was laborious. It was very meticulous. And like I said, it's 10 years in the making. I understand that some people can come up with theories and come out with books every couple of months and develop new and established theories, but that's not me. It took me 10 years to do this. And like I said, everything was based against the clinic, and then as the clinical success improved, I could see where modifications and changes to my idea of the philosophy behind homeopathy and the philosophy behind the miasms actually started to, look, it had to be altered to synchronize with the truth of what the clinic was telling me. But yes, I mean, it's the idea of syphilis affecting the human beings and that legacy that's passed on had been known for since syphilis came into Europe itself. And so, you know, it's not a long bow to draw that if Hahnemann is right, then the other two miasms should be doing it. But like you said, it's not an appearance. It's not a something that you can just say, well, look, there you go. This is for homeopaths who seriously want to practice. It's the study of HFA is an investment in your own clinical future. But be aware that it's not just a concept, so you can't just read a book and start. Like we were saying, it's an investment in those that want to practice. There are a number of homeopaths that are happy to be learners more than actual practitioners of it. But I like to think that HFA appeals to those that are practitioners.
Right. And also, you know, a patient may want to seek out somebody who does this specific type of technique because they are understanding that there is a high rate of success. In addition, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, there's a neurological specialist out of Canada who studies the faces of children who have been vaccinated, and he can see very clearly in all of the photographic data that he has collected over also like a decade of work, you can see the changes that occur in time from when a child is vaccinated and the destructive elements make asymmetry in their face, all sorts of things. So you can actually see it in one generation, in one lifespan, not over the course of many generations. So it seems like it confirms what you're saying about the expression of disease or the expression of these miasms in the way the features are constructed, you know, how they develop.
Well, if that can be seen over one lifetime and it's only from a vaccination,
yes,
then imagine what must be happening with this internal drive in the innis that, as Hahnemann talks about, has been here pretty much since the dawn of time. And that's exactly what we find, that people who's when we do their facial features and their psych, for example. Now, what we know is that every aspect of that patient is going to be psoric, including how they defend themselves against stress and disease. Now, this is where it becomes, going back to Hahnemann, for example. Hahnemann, as we know through chronic diseases, said, no, look, you can't just do the symptom totality only. I'm doing that when it comes to remedies like, you know, for typhus and scarlet fever and so on, you just do the sum total, but it doesn't work when you're doing it with chronic disease. There's something missing. And that missing part, of course, ended up, he called the miasms. But what we're looking at here is that the miasms are more than just something that shape and alter the body in accordance to their own design, but also to the way that everything about the human being, including the way that they defend themselves, is modified by these forces. And this is why I call them forces, and I've changed the idea from psychosis, syphilis, and sore into just more primary colours and things, not to be deliberately obscure, but to try and break away from the idea that it's just about disease only. It's about everything that encompasses being human. And like I said, that also includes the way that our immune system fights. It is the way that we defend ourselves against stress and infection, and we see this replicated in our remedies. Like, for example, one of the things that we notice about the psoriatic remedies, now if people want to know where I am originally getting these ideas, this one will certainly be Robert's, and this is the one that we accept as being as common knowledge now, but he is kind of the originator of this Hahnemannian principle that each one of the miasms works or has a force in its own way. Now, we see in Sora, for example, that Sora pushes to the circumference. We see this in remedies like Pulsatilla that emotionally push all of these things outwards. So you have the tears, you have the expression and so on that it's quite famous for. But you also see that with remedies like sulfur, where it has this what is called in Boracay, for example, a centrifugal action. Now, that centrifugal action is that it throws whatever is in the center of the body out to the surface of the skin. Whereas we see with psychosis, if we take Thuja or we take Metarhinum, then what we see there in those remedies is that that encapsulate the essence or the force of psychosis. Then what we see there is a lot of pus, a lot of catarrhal type of congestion, inflammation, warts, cysts, and so on. So we see that sore and psoriatic people have a tendency to throw out stress and infection, whereas psychotic people have a tendency to encapsulate and inflame stress or infection. Now, where this becomes absolutely vital for the practitioner, and this is why aggravations and remedies, well-selected remedies, fail to relieve, as many of the old books used to talk about, is that if you give sulfur to a person who is psychotic, then you are telling that body to push out, where its whole natural way of dealing with stress and disease is to imprison. So this imprisonment, either by inflammation, pus, catarrh, tumours, warts, cysts, it's all the same. And what it's trying to do is that your system is trying to encapsulate any infection, stopping it from becoming systemic. In the same way as sore is trying to throw to the periphery to protect the vital internal organs. And so if we are going to double up on the body's effort to be able to protect itself according to the program of which it's been designed, because we need to understand this, that the vital force. And if people, again, want to know where I'm getting referencing this information from, this is in the introduction to either the 4th, 5th or 6th edition. But what we see is that Hahnemann always refers to the vital force as unreasoning and instinctive and unintelligent. What we get, it's the same as a computer program where we are trying to do something and the program won't allow us to do it. And no matter how many times that signal ding cannot do or denied or whatever, it doesn't matter how many times we push it, we're going to get the same response because it's a program. And that's exactly what the vital force is. And Hahnemann refers to it as such. He refers to it as unintelligent instinct. This is why when we look at, say, aphorism 9, for example, where he talks about our unintelligent, our instinctive vital force as being different and delineated from our reason-gifted mind. Now, what this means is that once our program is put in place, meaning that we are going to push stress and disease out to the surface, or category B, psychosis, we are going to instinctively, unintelligently, but more importantly, consistently, like pushing the same button on the computer, we're still getting the same response. So we are going to consistently entrap through pus, catarrh, inflammation, wart, cyst, whatever. If, however, I come along as a clever little homeopath and a patient's sitting in front of me and I have no idea before the remedy that this person is psychotic because I don't know how to read facial analysis, I don't fully understand the concept of the miasms as Hahnemann was trying to present but still left a fair bit for us to develop. But I sit down there, I repertorize their case and I come up with a psoric remedy. Now, that psoric remedy is going to tell that psychotic program to push out. And that psychotic program is going to rebel against that remedy because that's not its psychotic design. Its design, it needs help to encapsulate. It will refuse, like a computer program, to push out because that is not its design. And as a result of that, this is why homeopathic literature in the past has library after library after library of books of practitioners saying, well, look, this was a well-repertorized remedy, but either A, it did nothing, or B, it just aggravated like crazy. I mean, we are full. I remember as a student almost too nervous to try homeopathic remedies because my head was so full of what can happen if you get the wrong one and all of the drastic calamity that can take place. Now, it made me almost too nervous to give it a go. But now I understand why that calamity is occurring when you are choosing a well-indicated remedy. Why that calamity is still occurring is because its fundamental base, the energy of that remedy, even though it repertorizes well, meaning that it is suitable to the presenting signs and symptoms, its underlying fundamental energy is not suited to the patient. Now, how Hahnemannian is this? This is modern day language and interpretation of what Hahnemann says in chronic diseases, isn't it? This is Hahnemann saying the presenting signs and symptoms are not enough to cure chronic disease. The underlying miasm must be included. But how do you do this if pathology isn't the right way to do it? Now, that has been a 200-year-old question that up until now homeopaths have not been able to answer. But with the facial analysis and understanding that the internal miasm forms everything physical, including our energy and the way that we protect ourselves, and more importantly, the facial structure itself, now we have a way of knowing before the calamity, sulfur be the right remedy for that person, no matter how well that remedy will repertorize, need a syphilitic remedy. They will never need a psoric one.
Can I ask a question here or make a comment?
Sure, it's your program.
The reason I'm saying this is because it's possible that many of the listeners over the course of time will not be very familiar with the the vernacular or even the concepts of what you're saying. And I just wanted to let people know that when a homeopath takes a case, they come up with a good number of potential remedies that can be the similimum or the matching the pattern of the individual. And when you do this analysis, you have, let's say, 5 or 10 that come up to the top that are really, really close. The remedies might be close to each other, or the remedies might seem to suit the presenting symptoms and signs of that the patient has during this. I assume you're talking about chronic, but possibly acute illness. And for that reason, what you're saying with this program with the facial analysis, it helps you distinguish which of them are going to fall into what miasmic category, so you can start to eliminate some of the ones that are at the top that come up to through the analysis. And I just wanted to make that clear, so if people maybe had in their mind what is happening, why are we choosing one category or one remedy. I hope that helps.
Yeah, well, okay, so if we go back to the absolute basics, so what happens is that homeopathy, the fundamental law is the law of similars, as we know. So a patient goes into a homeopath, the homeopath asks them about their case and what is their problem, all of the modalities, all of the concomitant factors, that is, allied factors that go along with the case that this patient is presenting. And then we do a repertorization, which is the sum total of the important things that need to be fixed. Then that in that repertorization, what we do is we come up with remedies that match that important section that we have. And so we know that via the law of similars that those, the remedy and the symptoms are going to interact. But what we have now also with our chronic disease is that we need to understand that there is something extra that we need to implement. Because when we do our repertorization, particularly if we're doing larger generals like worse right side or lungs inflammation of and so on, we can be left with maybe 20 or 30 remedies. Now, out of those 20 or 30 remedies, what we would normally have to do in the past is go to the Materia Medica and start looking up which one suited our patient or read best for our patient. Now, that's a very laborious task, and this, of course, is, and it's prone to making errors. Whereas what we have is that this is also too historically, and I won't go into this too much, but this is historically where essence prescribing began, because it was miles to hit and miss. People would, the homeopath would take the case, would repertorize on the case, and particularly back in those days where it was pen and paper, or more precisely quill and paper right at the very beginning, it's not like today where we have electronic repertorization, it would take a very long time to do it. And then all of a sudden you'd finally decide, you'd give the remedy and either nothing would happen, or even worse, the patient would get sicker than when they came in. Now, that sicker, that homeopathic aggravation that we're talking about here, is because you have the miasm wrong. I'm absolutely sure of it. The remedy has been well repertorized, but the miasm does not suit the patient, meaning the way that that patient is defending themselves against stress or infection by, you know, the psychotic inflammation and encapsulation versus the throwing outward of outward motion of the sore. So when they don't lock and key, you get a well repertorized remedy that either A, doesn't work, or causes an aggravation. Now, this is what all the books are full of. And as a result of that, one of the ways that we try to help explain that what was happening after all this effort is that we went down, we knew something had to be wrong, But what we came up with was that the essence of the patient, the personality of the patient, is what is probably wrong. And that has sent homeopathy on a completely different tangent to where Hahnemann really wanted it to go. There's no doubt that Hahnemann said the mentals of the case were very important, but he said the mentals of the case were an important differentiating factor after the generals of the case had already been decided upon, meaning that we do just the obvious first, worse right side, lung inflammation, difficult digestion, diarrhea, whatever. These are the major aspects and generals of the case. Then perhaps we could go off into this mental sphere. But what we have now is that we've got almost a two-tiered homeopathic environment that believes, one, that the mentals are the crux and just everything to do with homeopathy, and others that are saying, no, 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 we've got to get back to basics. But with the HFA, what we can do now is that we can stay in those basic Hahnemannian principles and the case taking of the obvious, but we can narrow down our choice dramatically with the facial analysis because we know what the essence or the energy of that patient's defense system is. So once we can lock and key that to the remedies that are in our repertorization, all of a sudden we might get, instead of 20 remedies or 25 remedies of which to choose from, we might suddenly now only have two or three. So instead of our patient coming back 20 times to get somewhere they may only need one, we might be lucky and get it right first time. I had a patient just yesterday who came in, their blood pressure for the last few years was, and they're only just in their very early 40s, was 175 over 110. It was going up. They'd been on blood pressure medication for quite a long time. The headaches are coming, thumping through, and they're daily, and it doesn't matter how many painkillers that they have. 2 weeks on belladonna because I know what miasm that she is. Her blood pressure is 124 over 82. I mean, we get dramatic results like this, very quick, very effective, and even if we do get it wrong first time, we know that the right remedy is in one of those two or three, not one of 20 or 30, and that's its benefit.
Wow. Okay. We have something like 7 minutes left of the show. I just wanted to let you know where we were with the show. And if we've covered most of the information that you wanted to present this evening, and we should check and to see if we have, I have a comment, Dr. Bob, on the chat says that was a good explanation. If there's any other questions there, we have Lana who has written in to say it. Here she goes. She said, based on the discussion earlier, she had been with her daughter to many homeopaths over 3 years trying to help with the DD differentials, disease differentials with her eczema, and they gave many, many different remedies and nothing helped. It wasn't until Lana found the homeopath who uses this particular system that she did. So she says they found that she is blue and mercury was the remedy for her. And so that is a testimonial for the fact that facial analysis does work, especially if people go from one homeopath to another. Let me see in our notes if there's anything else specifically that you, well, we didn't really go by what we were going to talk about. We just went off.
No, we didn't do anything like what we talked.
Yeah, well, we could do that. We could do that again. We could do another introduction the next time, because we really just dove right into the program, right into learning about people wanted to know what is facial analysis, how is it used, how do we work it, who should be taking the study of facial analysis. Is it mostly homeopaths who have already had a good solid education with classical homeopathy, or Is it somebody in another field, another alternative field, who might be interested in it? Maybe you can answer that as the last question.
Well, that's actually a very interesting question, because it depends on the training that the homeopath has had. Now, of course, I've devised this it's come from the homeopathic clinic, and it's specifically for homeopathy. So, obviously, I'm wanting homeopaths to adopt it. But like what we were talking about earlier with a lot of the mind symptoms, we've gone down a path which is what Hahnemann used to call in the Organon, we have gone down the line of transcendental speculation. So I guess it means that we're trying to almost look at remedies as anthropomorphic projections of people and see people's category, behavior and character represented into a fractal pattern that occurs in nature. Whereas, of course, that kind of doctrine of signatures is pre-Hahnemannian, not post-Hahnemannian. Hahnemann that's exactly, homeopathy today is exactly the medicine that Hahnemann was trying to change in the beginning. So what I guess, so there is a little bit of a problem with the adoption of HFA and its practicality that some homeopaths have a real problem with. It's not transcendental enough. It's not speculative enough. It's kind of boringly practical. And the enlightenment and the knowledge of the practitioner, the opening up of the transcendental veil, is not HFA's purpose. HFA is for people who have joined homeopathy to make a career out of it and to help patients. And it works extremely well. Like I was saying, I mean, if people like testimonials, okay, I'll reach in. I grab another one yesterday. Again, a woman that had a post-pneumonial bronchial infection for the last 4 years, had been seeing both naturopaths and doctors. That was fixed in 2 weeks, and it was fixed under Veratrum album. But I would never have picked Veratrum album unless her facial structure told me that that was the group that she belonged to. So, look, I am willing to teach HFA to anyone at all. But, of course, my preference is for homeopaths, because they know what it is that we're doing. I don't have to train them in the remedies. I don't have to train them how to repertorize and so on. So they're my preference. But my absolute preference is for homeopaths that are not necessarily brainwashed into the more spectacular and looking for the fascinating and the doctrine of signatures type of homeopathy that is currently so dominant. It's more, look, I'm here. My whole job is not necessarily to look at homeopathy as a way of enlightening my knowledge. I am going into homeopathy to, as Hahnemann used to say, be of service to my patients. What is the most practical way that I can achieve this, and what is the most reproducible way that I can achieve this? The whole aim of HFA is not student-based. It is practitioner to patient base. So if anyone who's really dedicated to that, then I'm happy to take them on.
Okay. Well, I'm going to conclude today's introduction with you. I'm so thrilled. Let's tell people again where they can find you. That is at www.vcch.org. Where you're going to find Grant Bentley lecturing at the Victorian College of Classical Homeopathy, and all about his miasm research, and links to his books, many podcasts, and a wealth of knowledge. We'll be talking about that in the coming weeks and months as we continue to study and learn what is the homeopathy and facial analysis. So I'm going to conclude today's show and say thank you very much.
It's my absolute pleasure, Debbie, and it was nice to talk to you again.
Okay. Bye-bye, everybody. Send us your
Bye-bye.
Comments. Send us your comments and questions, and share it with your friends.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy and Facial Analysis on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopaths Debbie Bruck and Grant Bentley. We encourage you to follow our show. Click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air. Share with friends on Facebook and MySpace and also Twitter. We welcome your comments and questions. See you next time.